I'm going to bring out today, maybe they could shed some light on that secret recipe that Pixar has. So without further ado, I am very happy to bring out folks who made this film, producer Lindsay Collins and director Andrew Stanton. And Lindsay Collins.
Hi.
So, right off the bat, we have to ask, you made us wait 13 years for a Finding Nemo follow-up. 13 years, sir. Well, why now? Why 13 years later?
Well, the real truth is I just wasn't expecting to ever go back. 4 years with Fish is a long time to work on a movie, and I thought Nemo was a closed little circuit, nice finished little picture, and moved on. And the brain's an interesting thing. So suddenly I was watching the movie again because I hadn't watched it in years. In 2011, we had to see the 3D version. And I walked out very worried about Dory. And I couldn't stop thinking about how she needed closure.
Yeah, I think you were, as a writer and as a filmmaker, you were like, how could I have left her incomplete?
Yeah.
So it started bugging him. And then we kept it to ourselves for a while.
Yeah.
And then when we felt like you really wanted to do it, we kind of went to John Lasseter and was like, so we have this idea.
Yeah.
And he was okay with it.
Once you say Finding Anything, they're going to want to make it. So.
Yeah, because Finding Nemo is such a classic movie, and to kind of take the reins of a follow-up, I imagine is Pixar embraces that right away, or they're like, well, this is a classic that we're...
There is no Pixar. I mean, that's a bunch of us. It's John, and that once we have the conversation, it kind of happens. Everybody kind of thinks there's some committee or some tribunal at Disney or something. It's just a bunch of us, and we go, hey, I feel like making this. What do you think? It's about that.
Awesome. So let's go. Let's have some questions. So we're going to come right here, right over here. Yes, the woman in black.
Hi, guys. Great job. Wanted to ask you a little bit about the themes of this film in terms of kind of the emotional beats and the whole just keep swimming and the shells and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about that, hitting those emotional beats and coming up with those ideas for the film?
Well, I always knew that the film was going to be about her accepting herself, that it was going to be under the tent of self-acceptance. It was the specificity of that like it took a long time to really, really nail down what exactly are we saying about that. And it was really about the premise I ultimately came with is that you're not at peace until you can truly accept who you are. And I think that she was always going to be unsettled until she experienced what it was like to succeed on her own completely. And I don't think she ever really had. I don't think she had learned how to survive in the wild by being the best co-pilot ever. And that meant she was always dependent on somebody else be successful. And so I knew that the only way she was going to feel completely fulfilled is if she, like a little kid, did it all by myself. And so that was really a grand design to just do that simple thing for her.
It was funny. I think, we also felt as though she needed to kind of grant herself the same grace that she feels like she grants everybody else. And I mean that only in that, she kind of apologizes for herself. Always says, it's her first sentence, I'm sorry, I suffer from short-term memory loss. And she never expects anybody to apologize for themselves, and in fact is kind of more open with them than anybody. And I think it's why people love Dory, and why the Just Keep Swimming kind of resonates so clearly, is because it's such a genuine, like, it's okay, just persevere, you're going to do it. And it's such a kind of a lovely sentiment. And so the fact that she, as a character, was not giving herself that same grace, it was like, how do we get her to that place, and who grants that to her? And then you were like, the only person that can grant that to her is herself.
And I've never really said this before, but like, Just Keep Swimming was a mantra that was taught to us in the first movie. And I think what I needed to do was make that personal for her. And she didn't realize it was actually something that was taught to her by her parents, and you have to combine it with what would Dory do. And when the two come together, that's really was the power of those two things together. A loaded question.
come right here in the front row.
Yeah,
As Lindsay already knows, I'm in love with this film.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Andrew.
Well, thank you.
You knocked it out of the park. I want to ask about the music in the film. It's very simple. It's very elegant. Thomas Newman's score is beauteous.
Yeah.
As an understatement.
Yeah.
The two songs that you select, though, the, All That We Hear, timeless classics. What led you to those selections?
It was sort of thematic to just the first movie. There was, I think we were under a little pressure to put a song for marketing reasons at the end of Finding Nemo. And I really didn't want it, the movie to suddenly be tainted with this sort of sellout quality to it. And so I suggested this pre-existing song that I had heard Robbie Williams do of Beyond the Sea. And I just felt like it was an old classic. It was, but it had a very modern sort of appreciation for it. And it just fit. It just kind of fit. And so fortunately we were able to get the rights. And that sort of set kind of a bar or a tone for the next movie. I felt like we should do the same. And the...
You always want an unforgettable.
I always want an unforgettable. It just...
was always at the end of the movie.
Like, it was who.
Yeah, it was just who was going to sing it. And then...
The Louis Armstrong song was... Honestly, I already had a Louis Armstrong song in WALL-E, and I was like, really? Should I really do Go There Again? And but the funny thing is that my co-director, Angus McLean, had come up with that song, and it was so funny. And we tried all these other songs, and it just lost its humor. It was not funny. It's that voodoo of comedy that, like, suddenly that idea plus Louis Armstrong was funny. So.
And yeah, and it's just, I think it was the genuine, like, the slow-mo, overly dramatic kind of Thelma and Louise, like, moment combined with this.
And that song, in a weird, now that I think about it, that Louis Armstrong, you know, What a Wonderful, it's kind of Dory. It's just, like, it's just so unabashedly hopeful.
Yeah.
You know?
And then Sia. So we ended up with Sia, who did a fantastic job with that. Unforgettable.
Yes, right.
I love the movie, too. I think I love the side characters as much as I love Dory and Marlin and Nemo. I just wanted to know, who were your favorite? Did you have a favorite of the side characters?
I know, that's such a tough question, because you try to put everything in each character so that they really stick. And it's great that there's a debate. Like, that's great. I think that I've spent the most time with Hank because he had such a deep role. I was telling Ed O'Neill, like, you're the Dory of this movie. You're the sidekick of this movie. And it's so funny. We recorded with him for like two or three sessions. And then we'd worked with him for a year, and we were finally showing a clip of it at D23 last year. And he's like, he goes, Andrew, come here in the green room. And I go, what? And he goes, this is a big character. And I go, yes, it's a big character, Ed. It's like, didn't you read the script when we said it to you?
I don't think
he really got how influential Hank is in the movie and how appealing he is, you know. So I think it's simply because of trench time spent with him that I think he stands out. But I love all of them so much.
I mean, Bailey and Destiny.
I voice Crush, which is from the other one. And now I also voice the loudmouth clam. Which is so obnoxious. So nice to be here. Yeah, it's really annoying.
We tried to recast that, and again, comedy.
Yeah.
Wasn't as funny without him.
Yeah.
Lindsay, what about you? Who's your
favorite? I love, you know, Destiny and Bailey. I just think they're funny and charming, and I love that there's this kind of back and forth between them. Ty Burrell's voice just makes me laugh every time. He's got this just charm to him. But you know, then there's Diane Keaton, and just the heartbreakingly way she delivers the speech to her daughter, tells her never to apologize for herself again. You know, those are just these moments in the film that when you get to watch these actors perform these moments, it's like,
oh, and that's why you get nominated.
You could hear a pin drop when she was doing it.
I would be remiss to not mention Becky, who is like my favorite.
Becky.
Because I feel like we all have that person Becky. In our life who's kind of a train wreck, but is really good
at
something. And you're like,
right.
Oh, well, we got to call Becky for this one.
Yeah.
You know, it's gonna happen. But yeah, Becky was just
awesome. Basically, we needed a surrogate Dory moment. They needed to know what it was like to miss out and they needed to basically put in a test run with, as if they were with Dory. So we needed another crazy female, you know,
and
crazy but actually smarter than the rest of them and totally underestimated.
Our production manager's name is Becky,
but she's nothing like Becky.
She's like, really, you guys? We're like, it's cool. We don't think that way about you. But actually, I think she's. I mean, like. Becky is just as wacky and charming in moments as Becky, and then it's one of our associate editors who does the voice of Becky.
Yeah, and again, we try to also do that. Is the voice of Gerald.
Gerald and Becky. Yeah, the two.
Yeah.
Comedy relief.
Well, Becky better get a doll. That's all I have to say. Over here.
Following up on that, it's interesting looking at the balance between old characters and new in this film, and I'm wondering if you just talk a little bit about how you decided on who was going to come back and how you balance them against new characters.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of want the story to tell you, and Crush came a little late. We needed a fast way to get across the ocean for a while. We were taking a long
Andrew
time.
Andrew was fighting putting Crush back in.
I just thought it would look like a vanity move. And I didn't want
we had to like twist your arm. Like, dude, seriously, he needs to be in the movie.
So then
the Germans wanted the sharks.
They really did.
They made it very clear to us.
You could name any cast member from the first movie, and there's a contingency of people that want it. And so it kind of negates itself. You just kind of go, look, I'm just going to go with what the story's asking for. I tried really hard to have the tanking, and for a long time, a subplot with Marlin. And it was a great storyline. Yeah. It will be on the DVD, but it just didn't...
It took away from
Dory's story. And what we ended up being much stronger, simpler and much stronger. So... we have 4 years to work on the movie, so it's a long time to take a lot of wrong decisions and allow yourself to just find out the hard way, I don't want to use that character, I want to use this character. So I totally take advantage of that luxury.
You really had a high bar for wanting it to feel like a standalone, different film. I mean, you know, so that in some ways you almost were...
I don't want to be reliant on history. Like there's a huge possibility that a lot of kids are going to see this first, and once they're both just movies you select online or whatever, who's to say which one you watch? And we really wanted to make sure you could watch them in either order.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thank you for this movie. It's really great. And coming back to Hank, how much of the improvement of the technology helped build his character? And my son told he missed the shark, Bruce.
Oh,
well,
yeah. I apologize.
He told me, where was the shark? I was like,
I'm gonna let somebody down, right?
Hank, you know, look, we could not have done Hank. We barely could do Hank on this film. I think the minute that character, you know, was in the script, and we approached our character team and our designers with this, it's like, okay, it's going to be an octopus. And we had been doing enough research at that point that everybody knew that when we said octopus, what that meant. I mean, we had already, you know, because we go to aquariums and we do all this research, and one of the coolest characters in an aquarium and the most stories that the aquarists have about octopus, you know, escaping and all this stuff. And so they knew that if we were going to do this, we needed to make this character like literally a jack of all trades. Yeah. Get in anywhere, which meant that there was no skeletal structure, so they had to be able to smush down into the smallest space and then expand and walk across. So it took 2 years to make that character. Our normal characters take about 6 months.
It took 6 months just to animate the first shot of him. And we would still be making the movie right now had we not learned how to do that a little faster. But
Hank has set the bar for sure. Yeah.
Yes, right here.
You talked about self-acceptance being something that was important to you, but I also noticed a theme of the fact that Dory learns differently than most people do.
Yes.
Growing up with a disability, if I had a movie like this, life would have been so much better. So was that something that was important to you when you were telling the story?
Well, I mean, I was trying to be, I'll be honest with you, I was trying to be universal with her unique specificity in a weird way. Like, I mean, nobody wants to watch a character be a generalization of something, so you go very specific, but you're hopefully saying something universal with it. So I was not trying to just talk about anybody with a disability. I was trying to say, I was using her disability to represent everybody. And I think the obvious category that comes first is people with an obvious handicap. But I also think it works for anybody, because nobody, well, maybe there are people you know that think they're perfect, but nobody is, and everybody has a flaw that they maybe actually mislabeled as such, and they actually, it's a little bit of a reflection of my age. Like, I've hit middle age, and you just start to recognize that I'm not really going to change. I am who I am, and I got to own that, and I got to learn to start enjoying that fact. You know, the good and the bad, and I think that's what I wanted it to. So that I wanted it to not be exclusive. I wanted to talk to everybody. But I think it's wonderful that it speaks to anybody with a true disability. I think it's great.
You set it up in the first film too. I mean, I love the fact that, you know, Dory never acknowledges Nemo's little fin.
Yeah.
You know, when Destiny can't see right and she bumps in, she's like, I think you swim beautifully. I mean, she just kind of doesn't belabor those things or define anybody by their flaws. And it's such a quality that is true to her on the first film that it felt like, of course, we were going to be true to that on this film. And wouldn't that be nice if that's how she felt about herself?
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the decision to set it in a marine life aquarium versus the open ocean. One of the biggest surprises for me was when they crossed the ocean in like a minute. Uh-huh. And I was wondering if there were any justifications behind that, just beyond being different from the first one.
Well, it was a circuitous route. There wasn't one big plan, which shows how lumpy our process of working a story is. I only had one location that we didn't get to put in the first movie that I really wanted to. And it was a kelp forest because it's so unique. It's like redwood trees underwater. There's nothing else like it. And literally, that was the problem. There was nothing like that in the Great Barrier Reef. So I could make Dory's past be from anywhere. So we said, well, let's at least start there. I already know that would be a cool environment. Now I can look back and realize, oh, this actually has more meaning behind it. Because I was in open water traveling, searching for Nemo all over in the first one. So it's very much more like traveling the desert. This one, it's like a forest. It's like a fairy tale, and in fairy tales, things are hidden, secrets are hidden in the forest, and you know, things are discovered in the forest. And I realized that's why it just kept working, and that put us right by the coastline, just because of the truth of where those kelp forests are. And then once we started to look back at this, you know, unintentional breadcrumb trail of Dory's, like she knows how to speak English, read, and she knows how to speak whale, and she's just got this odd, eclectic, you know,
knowledge
of stuff, and so I think she has to be around humanity. I think she has to have just seen some of the most bizarre
stuff. We loved
being
able to explain some of that, because you never had to in the first film. You just kind of took it, and you're like, oh, great. I mean, but now the fact that we had this opportunity to kind of, is there some explanation for why she knows and does the things she does?
In an early past, there was a moment where she was at the glass revisiting her exhibit, and everything she'd ever said had an association on the wall, like Kaiser Soze at the end of Usual Suspects. It was like,
awesome.
It was like, you know, Sea Monkey has my money, like little thing. There was just like all these weird, like Natural Blue. There was like all these things.
Yeah.
And it was funny in the moment, but it was so reliant that you were like an expert on the first movie that we just didn't use
it. It's funny.
But the more we delved into just, like, we knew about the Monterey Bay Aquarium. We're very authoritative on the California coast because of where we are. It all just started to work. It brought in all these new species. It brought in sort of, we could be at the ocean, but right inland with people, and it's just started to really work. And then once it found the theme of rescue, rehabilitation, and release, which really was the subtle arc of her character, it just all fit like a glove. And we just stayed there. So that was the short answer to that question.
Yeah, and you mentioned that. I can't help but think of Sigourney Weaver, and I'm just like, how did Sigourney... Why Sigourney Weaver?
Well, she's sort of the David Attenborough of this country, right? She has to do all... She does all these narrations for nature and things like that, and she's the voice of the planetarium show at the Academy of Sciences.
San Francisco,
you know? So I thought, how funny would that be?
First of all, I mean, obviously her voice is soothing and smart, and then her name is so specific.
Yeah.
And so we put it in really, truly, which we do a lot, like, because we screen this film so many times, and it's all internal. We put a lot of jokes, knowing full well that that joke will never see the light of day, just because it makes us laugh, and we're like, it's totally inappropriate, and it's never going to see the light of day. And that was one of those jokes. We were like, we'll just put Sigourney Weaver in there, and so, like, because it'll get a laugh. And then it got a laugh, and then it kind of, the next screening, it kept getting a screen, and we kept saying it more and more. And then literally we waited until the last minute, because we were like, there, at some point somebody's going to be like, this is too weird, you have to take it out. and they didn't. And so finally we were like, I think they're going to let us keep it in. And so then we called Sigourney, and Andrew was like, these kids are going to know your name in a way that nobody knows your name. and it warned her, and she was up for it.
Yeah, God bless her.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's right here.
In a positive point of view, what did you gain by releasing this final cut 13 years later? You know what I mean? Because everybody seems to ask you, what took you so long? Mm-hmm. In a positive point of view, what did you gain by waiting so long?
Oh, interesting. I was certainly a better writer, a better filmmaker by that time. And I knowing what we had to tackle and solve, I don't think I could have solved it earlier. I think I would have failed. I honestly can say I was paired with the smartest writer, the smartest co-director, the smartest head of story, the smartest editor, the smartest producer, and we were all constantly banging our heads against the wall trying to solve this movie without giving up for 3.5 years. And it was a very recalcitrant story. It just kept just giving us little inches of gain, but never the full answer. And I don't think I could have solved this movie any sooner. So I'm kind of glad it came then, you know, in that sense. Yeah.
Yes, right.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you. I love the movie, by the way. We talked about in other interviews about the diversity of characters in this movie. But there is like a little specific scene that's creating some controversy in the social network. So I want to know, is that a lesbian couple? And what do you think about all this bullshit people are saying about it?
No, it's like we laugh because we're like, our honest answer is maybe we didn't ask them.
We didn't ask them.
Honestly, like we basically populate our world the way we see our world, and we don't kind of sit there and ask everybody's background when we put them in our movie. So if it was a main character, I think we would know the answer to that question. It's not. It's just part of the world, and it's part of the world we see. And
it's probably it's a little bit more reflection of the times, because there's a lot of shots in all our movies with two people of the same gender in it. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, if you want to pick that one, but. Yeah. But we have no problem with whatever you want it to be. It's just
we
honestly don't know.
We don't know.
This is our last question. Sir, in the back.
Some of the voice casting seems almost counterintuitive. Could you talk about casting Ed O'Neill, a kind of everyman, as your octopus character? Also, Eugene Levy, a comic actor, playing a very straight role.
Yeah. You know, I would never think they're counterintuitive. Not to be counter to your counterintuitive comment, but everybody in this cast that was new was my first choice, and that's the one real great perk and the one easy thing about this film was, because it was the sequel to a hit, they'd answer your phone calls. And they all said yes when you asked for them to play a role. And I always pictured Diane Keaton and Eugene Levy as the parents. It just, and in the original version of this film, as we were trying to write it early, they all had short-term memory loss. And I highly recommend you never do that, because it was the most annoying scenes, and it was frustrating. But I thought, I could see Diane Keaton with this sort of Annie Hall-esque kind of like flightiness, and I could see Eugene Levy with this absent-minded kind of dad, and they're both very sweet and loving. But when I took away the short-term memory loss, they were still so appealing that you could kind of see how Dory came from the two DNAs of those people.
I mean, like, Eugene, I always see as this optimistic, like, I mean, there's not a kind of snarky bone in his body, and there isn't one in Dory's either. Yeah. And so you kind of see that,
or
Jenny's. Like, I mean, neither, like, there's no snark. Yeah. To their humor or to their love. And so it's like that genuine kind of spirit is in Dory. And then
I made this Freudian connection with an interview earlier today, and I never put it together. It's like, Eugene's a little in the same camp as Albert Brooks. They're kind of from the same tribe a bit, like they're like slightly different flavors. So I bet you she felt very comfortable being around Marlon, because it reminded her of Dad.
Yeah, there you go. That's probably why they stuck together for so long. And then Ed O'Neill, I mean, God, you can tell that we are big fans of Modern Family when we were casting this movie, because it's Ed O'Neill to us, I mean, was always the perfect casting for this, because he is so kind of gruff.
But you can hear the heart of gold.
But you never doubt that kind of if you just get past there, like that is a squishy octopus.
Yeah, it's a softie.
It's a squishy octopus underneath that shell.
So. Where does Idris Elba? Idris Elba, for me, stole a lot of
my scenes. My blatant thing is that I just wanted a Wire reunion.
That's true.
And I knew Dominic, and I was like, look, can I get you and Idris in the same room together just so I can witness a Wire reunion? I didn't ask that, but like, I did secretly hope for that. But I also love the idea that they're in this country, and maybe some others, people don't know they're British. They can do American accents so well that they fool everybody. I think maybe it's known now by everybody. But I just love them just being themselves, being mates, and there's something I couldn't explain it. It's just the voodoo of comedy. To this day, I haven't tried to rationalize it. I just thought, okay, you're in international waters. They can be whatever nationality you want. Just make them lazy Brits. Just make them lazy Brits on a rock. And it was funny. I don't know.
Brits on a rock.
It was amazing.
Name of a pub somewhere in England. Lazy Brits on a Rock.
Awesome. Round of applause, please. Thank you, Stanton.